Well, thank you, Jim. First, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, my colleague Kevin Royal with Winfield Solutions. Kevin and I developed a tool that we're just launching in collaboration with a company in France called Geosys, and Damien Laputre is president of Geosys, an image management company. I'm going to limit my discussion today on nitrogen management in corn. I owe Jim Shepherds a great deal in my career, and one of the things was the advice he gave me as a grad student. He said, study nitrogen management in corn, and you'll always have a job. The point was, it's complicated, and about the time you think you're making progress, something else will change in the environment that may correct your assumption. So I'll talk a little bit about that, and it's also going to sound a little like anti-science after the other talks in this symposium. I think our approach has been to maybe step backwards on refining the algorithms and the things we're getting from sensors, and let's take a 30,000-foot view of the challenge. Our approach is to figure out how do we engage the grower, and we may not have to have the exact algorithm or the exact pounds of N needed or kilograms needed or the exact NDVI calibrated to a ground-based sensor. Our approach is let's step back and say there's maybe some variability out there in this field. Let's get the grower's input on what we should do about it and do they want to approach it. So kind of some of the things that Dave Franzen talked about earlier. The opportunity has existed. Dave mentioned it. Remote sensing of crop canopy and reflectance is going to help us improve nutrient management. And I think what Dave mentioned was what I'm going to mention when. We've heard that since the 1970s. I recall my major professor in my master's was taking infrared photos from an airplane and ektachrome photos and then going back out to help growers ascertain what was the problem or differences that they saw, and that was in the 1970s. And we all probably assumed at various stages over the last 30 or 40 years that we're really close to using this information to make better management decisions. And the flat fact is, it's still relatively unused technology in much of the world we live in. Problem is, as the relationship status on Facebook can say, it's just complicated. Managing nitrogen is intriguing in corn systems just because of the impact weather has. Advising a grower with much certainty on how much nitrogen, how and where and when to apply it, it's complicated. About the time you think you got it figured out, the weather's going to throw you a curve to demonstrate how little you perhaps knew. Whether it's wet soils, cold weather, that means reduced mineralization. We've already talked about that in the symposium. It's just very difficult to manage a nutrient that the plant needs in such great quantities, and yet the soil finds new ways to lose nitrogen every year. It's very difficult. There's lots of ways we can lose nitrogen, largely based on excess water. It's difficult to come out with the right answer. Today I'm going to cover a little bit about the science, and this truly will be a high-level overview of the science of what we know in fine-tuning nitrogen management. But the problem, again, goes back to if we know so much about this, and we've been studying this for so long, why isn't it catching on? Why aren't more growers doing a better job using all this great science in their cropping systems? It is complicated. There's lots of interactions, and they're all impacted by weather that we can't control. And the other thing I want to introduce is that genotypes do differ, and there's been a great change in the way we develop corn hybrids over the last couple of years. It's been building and building, but now we're really seeing major hybrid differences, it's not easy to ascertain brand new hybrids, and it's been mentioned that genetics turn over so quickly. How can we get good data? I'm going to talk a little bit about our approach and priorities in developing a tool, and then talk a little bit about what we're doing to help growers improve their management. So Bill Ron, Jim Shepherds, and Ron Laurie worked in the 80s on a couple of key findings. One, the corn plant is a luxury consumer of nitrogen. It basically takes up more nitrogen than it ever needs for maximum yield. So direct measurement of how much nitrogen in the plant was really not very helpful in fine-tuning nitrogen management. What Jim and colleagues discovered is that it won't make any more chlorophyll than it really needs. And chlorophyll then becomes a good pseudonym or a good trait to measure, a characteristic to measure, to improve, to let the plant tell us how much nitrogen is sufficient. We did a little work on the chlorophyll meter, and you know, we sort of stumbled into some happy corn principles. I just heard that. Should have used that back then. But 95% sufficiency is happy corn. Really a wild-ass guess, just looking at some spreadsheets, and it continued to work. That if you compare what a reference strip was and the SPAD meter from the rest of the field, 95% really indicated about sufficient nitrogen. Less than 95% means give me some more nitrogen quickly or it's going to cost you yield. The whole concept, whether we're using remote sensing, sensors, or SPAD meter readings, or even direct tissue sampling, we want to find out, is there a way the plant can tell us, you know, in a very simple way, do you have enough nitrogen or do you need more? And can we fix that with the nutrient application before it costs us yield? In the 90s, the continued work by a lot of folks continued to learn how much can you stress the plant and it can still recover from yield. The recoverable end stress, you know, can we find sensors that will uncover this developing deficiency and we can still fix it in time that it doesn't cost us yield? And the family of sensors that we've heard about today, they do work. They do work. We've also heard society, whether it's in Europe or other places, eventually here, there's going to be continued pressure on agriculture to do a better job of managing nitrogen. Farmers don't pay the external cost of over-application. And we don't have a system where growers basically need to be concerned about contamination. Yes, the price of fertilizer continues to increase, and that encourages growers to do a better job, but they still avoid some of the external costs of groundwater and surface water contamination by nitrogen. We can expect that we'll see continued pressure on agriculture to continue to do a better job. So you can tell where I borrowed this slide from. The understanding of when the plant needs to take up its nitrogen and contrast that with when our environment and soil environment typically supplies nitrogen, there's the rub. We used to say that, you know, in May and June and July and much of the Corn Belt, we're subject to massive rainfall events that can really destroy our nitrogen management processes. Last year at the ASA meetings, we heard from Tom Friedman, who talked about, instead of global warming, global weirding of our weather. And I know across the Corn Belt this year, we've had several rainfalls that exceed 7 and 10 inches in central Nebraska. We've seen 15-inch rainfalls in eastern Iowa in August, and we've seen 15-inch rainfalls over a two-day period in West Tennessee. There is something going on that we continue to have dramatically wild rainfall events. So my point here is that whenever we have a an uptake curve like this, and we're depending on the soil solution to provide sufficient nitrogen to that plant during its period of rapid uptake, the 2 or 3 weeks prior to tassel. If you do the math where that plant needs to take up 5, 7, 8 pounds per acre per day, then calculate if the water, the soil solution, or the water content of that soil is a certain level. Calculate what concentration of nitrate nitrogen we need in that soil solution during that period of rapid uptake. We're always going to be vulnerable to a massive rainfall event. There's no way we can provide sufficient nitrogen to a high-yielding corn crop without leaving ourselves vulnerable at some period during that period. Now, I don't know what the answer is, but it's always going to be one of those variables that we need to live with. The other thing I want to point out is how rapidly marker-assisted selection has changed the corn yield potential. You know, we've known the structure of DNA from Watson and Crick here since the 50s. And it's only recently we've started seeing massive changes in the yield potential of the corn hybrids. We did a little back-of-the-envelope calculation recently, and the amount of dollars spent on genetic improvement through breeding and biotech by the major industries is roughly 50 times what it was just in 1990. The massive investment here by the major players has changed the yield potential pretty dramatically. The only way that our company can figure out how we're going to understand how these hybrids perform, since they're changing so quickly, is to put out a lot of locations of plots. Now, compared to the research we've seen presented today, our research is going to look very crude. It's, the old joke about measure with a micrometer and cut with an axe. Our research is cutting with an axe here. We're doing characterization research to find dramatic differences in these new hybrids. Specifically, we want to go to, next year it'll be over 200 locations across the areas we grow corn. And we're trying to figure out, what is the response to nitrogen? What is the response to population? We see more continuous corn coming into our future all the time, so we're trying to screen hybrids for their tolerance to corn on corn, and then which genotypes respond to fungicide. Now, if you have a lot of hybrids and you have a lot of locations, the costs go up pretty dramatically if you want to do a lot of treatments. So we've simplified this to pretty much two treatments. These are two factorial treatments. In nitrogen, for example, we just apply a zero and an unlimited rate. And we're looking for slope of the difference between zero and unlimited. And we hope that that slope difference helps us sort hybrids. Similar with the other factors here. We're often just looking at two levels of factorial equation. Put in a lot of locations, we're just looking for vast differences. Go back to the yield potential here. A couple of years ago, 2 years ago, we haven't got a lot of harvest in this year yet, but out in Nebraska, we were looking at a couple of the answer plot locations where the yields of the top hybrids were 350 to 370 bushel per acre. And the intriguing things that hybrids that were good hybrids just a few years older, released in 2004, 2005, were still doing well, but they were 100 bushels less than the top yielding hybrids. And we started to think about how dramatically is the old rules of understanding corn hybrid changing in effect. We know that the genetic background that goes into these hybrids does impact its nitrogen response. Typically, we talk about heterotic groups of hybrids, and this one looks like this, so it'll probably be responding like this. The Ohio 43s, the Holden lines, and some of the other B73 and the lines that everybody's using However, this molecular breeding has mixed up the mix quite a bit and made it more difficult to understand that hybrid will probably respond like this because it looks like its parents. These factors are changing pretty dramatically. Again, going back to our measurement with an axe research, the comparison between 0 and unlimited n, actually in some of the locations where we don't expect to get anything with a 0 n, we do apply a minimal rate. But basically, you're looking at the difference between low and high n rates at a lot of locations. And the average response, again, sorry, this is in bushels per acre, but the average response is 93 bushels per acre in between 0 and unlimited. However, there are certain heterotic groups that consistently are different than that. Those from the more northern and more western type heritage, where these inbreds lines were developed, tend to be less responsive to nitrogen. Now, also that mixes up the timing factor. By just doing 0 and n and then unlimited, we are ignoring the fact that some hybrids require more nitrogen early versus some hybrids seem to be able to take it up way late into their growing pattern. But the fact is that there are hybrid differences out there, and we want to make sure that that is used and considered in management. So what can we do? There's a lot of spatial variability out there, and with yield monitors, we would have thought many people would be collecting really good information by now. And the fact is, many of the growers still need help understanding and managing in-field variability in their fields. We've also made the assumption that technology to vary these inputs, whether seed or nitrogen rate, is going to be available. If it's not now, it's probably soon to be available to growers. Our founding principle is that whatever recommendation we want to make to growers must be based on sound science, even if it's not as refined as we may like it. We want to see these factors utilized to help growers make better management decisions. In other words, we might want to help large numbers of farmers make slightly better decisions on millions of acres than refine the application on 1 acre or on a small field. Finally, it has to be very easy to use. So these were our tenets as we went into deciding what could we do as a company to develop a plan. Last year at the meetings, Paul Fixon and Akeem Doberman talked about more genes or more agronomists. And the point was, there has to be a systems approach to helping growers get the most out of the latest technology, whether it's genes or whether it's nitrogen management. We still need local agronomists that are trained, understand some basic science, and they can help fine-tune and put the management practices in context with growers. So we're committed to helping support those agronomists with more and better information, never to replace them with an algorithm or a computer program. So a systems approach is needed. That, again, the value of a true local agronomist, an expert that looks at the operation, looks at all the factors, and truly they make some judgment calls that are soft skills and not based in science. They recognize some growers are less timely or more timely than others. Some are very good at calibrating all their equipment and are going to do the great job. And maybe they're the ones that can handle a management practice that requires more complexity, whereas others are concerned about speed. How do I get across my thousands of acres? And I don't care about managing to the nth detail. So nothing's out of context. And then growers do recognize the technologies all around them, and they want help from a local expert integrating it into their operation. So again, this sets up what are we doing. This is going to sound a little more salesy now, so bear with me for you academic types. But we've had this system called the R7 placement, that a job of an input supplier is to help growers get the right system context in place for their management. The right genetics, right soil type, cropping system, traits, nutrition, and crop protection. If you're not doing part of that, then we consider you're not doing your full job helping the grower. We developed a system with GeoSys that uses past historical imagery, the Landsat satellites you've heard referred to a few times. GeoSys has an archive of more than 20 years of Landsat history over most of the U.S. And Landsat satellite imagery is available. It is only the four bands that everybody deals with, but free, it's really hard to beat free when you talk about acquisition of imagery. And GeoSys has developed a system of cataloging all this information, creating, essentially, it's a slightly modified NDVI. They call it a yield potential map. But they have a lot of imagery data already collected and cataloged. And what we've done is work on a way to serve that up in a very simple, easy-to-use interface. It basically uses Google Earth to find your field. And once you find the field and assign it to a grower, the server cookie cuts the image data that it has going back 15 to 20 years, depending on your part of the world, and it doesn't do anything that's calibrated. It only serves up a relative value. But it does help bring out spatial variability in your field. We have a catalog of bare soil images, and this first map that I show is basically an enhanced bare soil map showing soil variability. And we enhance it with color so that growers can see that there really are differences out there. Also, on this carousel here, the thing is very easy to navigate around. It's kind of like an iPod interface that you can rotate that carousel and pull up other kinds of maps in the tool. But there are also usually four NDVI images called yield potential maps, but essentially the computer server goes in and finds all the maximum biomass for a year and then sorts it based on, it wants to find two wet years and two dry years and serve up those data on the carousel and then anything from the current year that it's got. So satellite revisit time in Landsat is about a 14 to 16 day window. Sometimes it's cloudy and sometimes you don't get a current year image, has been alluded to, but we can go in and without much knowledge of GIS or precision farming, almost all of our agronomists that deal with farmers can call up their field and have a look at some images that show variability in their field. We also use this as our platform to serve up some of that hybrid genotype-specific information that is developed from the answer plots. So the tool, we just launched it in August, late August. It's a web-based tool, so any grower or any co-op agronomist or retailer affiliated with our company can just use a browser and call it up. It's fairly simple. It does include information from this AnswerPlot network on hybrid responses to those factors I mentioned. The main thing is it's designed to use with a grower so that you get the grower engaged in deciphering spatial variability. And that's a great time to say to the grower, well, if that's always the best part of the field, do you think we should manage that differently? Or does it improve our scouting? Should we go out to that field and maybe take a look at some areas that you have concerns about? It has the capability of creating variable rate prescriptions. Again, it's going to be simplistic compared to some of the more sophisticated tools that are out there. And it's certainly going to be not very sophisticated compared to some of the other tactics and techniques we've been talking about in this symposium. But our point here is it's going to help growers and their crop advisors have a discussion about in-season variability and potentially what can we do to manage the challenges that are happening in that field. So, with that, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Does anybody have any questions for Todd? Any questions for Todd? Yes.
What kind of consistency have we seen across multiple years? It does vary with part of the country. You know, in north central Iowa, flat black, tile-drained soil, we've seen some very uniform fields, and we've also seen some variability that surprises growers. I'll say that the agreement with yield maps is usually somewhere over 80%, and I know that there's some earlier discussions about wildlife pest damage. That's been probably one of the more fun inconsistencies between an August, say, NDVI map and the final harvest map or yield map. Wildlife, deer and turkey, raccoons and other things, take a lot of grain out of some parts of our world. And that's been rather interesting to some southern Iowa-based farmers and as well as Indiana and Ohio growers that it seems like every field borders a woodlot and has waterways in it. I saw the solar corridor discussion earlier today, and wildlife loves solar corridor production, 60-inch corn production, but that's been probably one of the more interesting aspects that I think is that farmers don't know how much yield they're losing to deer and raccoons and turkeys in many parts of our world.
Do we have a question in the back? No? Okay. Does anybody else have any questions for any of the other speakers or any comments in general? Okay. I want to thank all the speakers. And before everybody leaves, let me tell you what's going to happen next, and you can decide if you want to stay or not. ASA has developed a new system. It's called communities. Instead of the old divisions and sections and all this stuff, they now have communities, people and groups of common interest. And so some earlier today I said it's like a prayer group, but it's a common interest type thing. You can belong to more than one. And so if you have an interest in sensors, sensor-based management, this sort of thing, we're going to have a meeting here, maybe only last 15 minutes or so. But the idea is for you to think about what you would like to see done at the national meetings next year. So you can be thinking about symposiums, speakers, awards for posters, for the sky's the limit. So we have a little bit of money to spend for that sort of thing. And so we're going to hang around, and we'll give you a few minutes. Those of you who'd like to leave and don't feel part of it, that's great. If you'd like to stay, hey, you're all welcome. And once again, you can belong to more than one community. There's other communities. There's one on precision agriculture that's going to meet later in the week. You can go to that one, too, because there's a lot of overlap. So we're exploring, but we're going to have this meeting shortly, and we'll see what the interest is for the future. So with that, please help me thank our speakers who came a long distance in some cases.